I'm Maya Grantz.
And I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love. And you know what? I know you've all been loving that college cheating scandal. We're going to ruin the shit out of it for you.
Yes, we're going to ruin college admissions and the entire process. And I can't even say we're going to ruin Tucker Carlson, because what's there to ruin? But we are going to break that shit down.
Yes.
And we have a very special guest to help us do it.
Very special guest.
We are going to be joined by Charlotte Clymer, writer and activist. You're going to love this one, listeners.
Stick around.
All right. We are here with Charlotte Clymer, our very special guest.
Woohoo!
Thank you so much for being here with us, Charlotte. Charlotte is a writer and LGBTQ activist and currently works for the Human Rights Campaign. So overall, is just an incredibly awesome person. We're going to be talking about all kinds of cool stuff, but before we get to that, I have to ask you both, how are you doing and what are you drinking?
Well, I would just like to say it's 9 a.m. in Los Angeles right now. Because I love my listeners so much, I am drinking a screwdriver. I'm drinking a top of the morning screwdriver.
That's a lovely way to start the day, I think.
It is just past noon for me here at work. And so, unfortunately, I'm not drinking yet, but in about 5 hours, I'm going to get fucking hammered. So I'm really looking forward to that.
But wait a second. But what will you be drinking so that our listeners can really feel it?
Gin and tonic.
All right.
Hands down.
A classic.
Just throw them down.
We can reinscribe that on you retroactively.
Right, exactly.
I love it.
I am having a coffee with spiced rum.
Oh, that's a nice middle of the day.
Yeah, it's middle of the day. Coffee gives you the little boost. The rum makes it a little fun.
It's a poor man's speedball.
Yes.
Is what it is.
Nice.
Yes. Let's talk about some of the stuff that's been going on, especially as relates to previous episodes. And then we have a little bit of listener feedback to share. And then we're going to jump into talking about the big stuff we wanted to talk about, like the college cheating scandal and
the
crap with Tucker Carlson. So,
Oh my God. Well, first of all, Beto announced, and you know that we at The Sauce have a longstanding opinion that if Beto was not a tall, skinny, white dude, this would never happen. Like, I really wanted him to win a senator of Texas, but I just feel like, what has he been doing? He's been doing instas of himself getting his teeth cleaned.
I know. He feels pretty redundant in the race at this point, but I'm actually glad that he announced his run. Because going back to what we talked about in our previous episode with Caitlin Byrd about Bernie, and she brought up this great point that Bernie sort of fills this niche that Obama left of the energetic candidate that people can really feel inspired by, and how people are really addicted to that kind of energy. And I feel like Beto brings that. And so he might kind of undermine Bernie a little bit, and they will be splitting the vote, as it were, for people who want that kind of energy, which I'm all for.
I've wanted to be charitable toward Beto. And so when that Vanity Fair cover got released, and, you know, when I heard he was announcing, I was like, okay, we'll be nice. You know, welcome into the race. It's good to have people in the race. Then I saw the announcement video the next morning, and I went back and deleted my Beto tweets. Not because I don't like Beto, not because I don't think that he's probably a fundamentally good person, but because he is so completely fucking tone deaf. I mean, having your wife sit next to you silently and just have this adoring and you know, I guess, laissez-faire look while you talk about what you're going to do for the country. And, oh, and that you'll help take care of the kids, by the way. While you're on the campaign trail. And I just, it made me so angry, so enraged, and so indicative of how I feel like he doesn't understand this moment that it just pissed me off. It really did.
There's also this thing where I'm like, you could run for senator again. Like, there are other things that you can do with your energy and with this base that you created. Mm-hmm. And this isn't the moment. I'm glad I didn't watch video. My brain was exploding.
I can't recall who tweeted this, but I saw a tweet that said, Beto realizes that if he runs for Senate again and loses, that's the end of his career. But if he runs for president and loses, it's not. So I sort of understand that logic, but it is a little annoying. It's really unnecessary for him to be involved in this at this point.
What a cynical calculus.
Right?
Wait, you're from Texas, Charlotte, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you feel like it was a smart move for him not to run for senator again? Do you feel like
No, I don't. And I also saw that tweet. I respectfully disagreed with it. I understand how someone could come to that theory or whatever, and I get the logic behind it. But honestly, I don't think that's it. I think that he honestly believes that he has what it takes to be elected president and to be a good president. And so he's going after it. Or, and maybe a secondary thing here is that he feels that a Democrat's definitely going to win in 2020. And that if it is Kamala Harris as the nominee or a woman or a person of color, that he will be the inevitable choice for VP.
Oh my gosh, that probably is what he's thinking.
You know,
I also think that he knows he could beat Cornyn, John Cornyn, in 2020. I think he knows that. He would just rather be vice president or president. That's just my personal opinion.
I think that's really interesting that you think he could beat Cornyn.
Yeah, of course he could beat Cornyn, because Cornyn's boring. Honestly, Cruz has such inflammatory rhetoric that gets people's blood pumping, especially if you're a Trump supporter or a right-wing hack. Cornyn, he has the same opinions, essentially, but he's not a firebrand. He doesn't get people riled up.
That's very interesting. You know who is making a similar calculus but then decided not to run, I think, is Eric Garcetti, is my mayor of LA. Because I think he was making a similar, like, I could run knowing that I'm not going to win, but running might get me out into the national sort of.
And it would.
Yeah.
Because he's not going to run for governor of California now, since Gavin Newsom is going to be, you know, the governor for the next 8 to 12 years or whatever the hell.
Especially
after this death penalty announcement. I mean, he's gonna do really well. So I thought Eric Garcetti made a really selfless choice not to run. I'm not going to praise him endlessly because it's fucking common sense that you don't run unless you need to. But I do think it's worthy of saying, you know, he had a platform, he had a path at least to get in the conversation, and he chose not to take it because he felt it wasn't right. And I'd say the same for Sherrod Brown, who, you know, hands down had a path, to, even more of a path than Beto or Garcetti. And, you know, he and his partner, Colin Schultz, decided not to go for it.
Yes. Thank you to Sherrod Brown for recognizing it wasn't the time.
Yes.
All right. In other news from the past few days, we do have to mention this horrible tragedy that occurred in New Zealand in Christchurch. There was a mass shooting at, if I understand correctly, a couple of mosques.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And 49 people murdered by a white supremacist terrorist.
With a manifesto. And it's interesting, I was just watching the documentary about the Oklahoma City bombing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we're going to have to at some point talk about this performance of manifestos.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there is a way in which these people think that they're fulfilling a message. And it's really like, it's just devastating.
And I think it's also particularly horrifying that in the manifesto, this person made explicit reference to things like memes and other artifacts of right-wing online culture that we've discussed on the podcast, you know, trolling the libs and just taken to this really tragically, horrifyingly violent culmination. And it might be worth circling back to that and addressing at some point, because it's
sure.
I do know that white supremacy has never gone away. It's always been there, but there is something going on right now where it's having a moment and with tragic consequences.
Well we'll talk about it when some time has passed and we can get our brains around it.
I think that's a good idea.
Oof.
Let's transition to something a little more positive and uplifting. We got some good listener feedback that I want to share. Specifically, a tweet from Kara Wagner, who goes by @KaraBera13 on Twitter. And she was referring to our last episode about Bernie and everything we think is wrong with Bernie with guest Caitlin Byrd. And she said, "This episode is everything I've never been able to fully articulate about why I despise, do not support, and will not support Bernie Sanders. Everyone must listen." So thank you for your enthusiastic agreement.
I cannot officially endorse or anti-endorse any candidates in this race because I work for HRC.
Right.
But I will say there's a lot to be said for privilege and understanding that this is a moment in which people without privilege should be amplified. And I would hope that those with privilege would take a step back and create more space at the table for everybody else. That's all I'll say on that.
Well, yeah. Said. And you know what? I think that we're going to get deep into that.
Yeah, we probably will have a chance to address that. One other quick tweet I wanted to share was from our listener, Arnim Sommer, who goes by at Arnim Renthoron on Twitter. And they suggested a very interesting topic idea for a future episode, saying, "Now you should rant about how Hollywood doesn't provide good presidents," and gave the examples of Dave and the American president and Independence Day as Hollywood depictions of presidents. And I thought that seems like a really fruitful topic that we definitely should get into.
I like that.
To do that, we have to include the representation of Joan Allen as the like vice president sort of
the contender.
Yeah, we have to, the contender, we have to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That has my favorite presidential speech of all time. The one at the end where Jackson Evans, I think is his name. Anyway, he gives this soaring speech about, you know, gender and why it's important to confirm his nominee. And I was like, oh, fuck, this is great.
I know. You're like, this is great. This would never happen. Yeah.
This but would it's never also, happen. It's great.
You know what I think is really interesting? I think every president Hollywood character has a name that's two last names.
Is that right?
Jackson Evans. Well, I just feel not, like that's such a like.
Not Dave.
Well, not Dave. Okay, fine. But
It's the character's name, not the president.
That's the character's name, not the president. All right. Well, that's a theory that we'll have to see
through.
We'll
examine that one at a later time. All right. We should get into our main topic because we've got a lot to discuss. When we invited Charlotte to join us for this podcast and we were brainstorming topics, we had a lot of really wonderful ideas. And we were all set to talk about what Charlotte had to say about having been in the military and patriotism in American culture and politics. And I do want to still talk about that. But things happened in the news that we felt were so urgently in need of dissection that we had to set aside all our other ideas.
And not only did we think we had to, our listeners did too. We got an email that basically said, "Cover the college cheating scandal. That is all."
Oh, wow.
"Please do this college admissions bribery story." That was in the subject line. Okay. And then I opened the email and it just said, "That is all." I was like, okay.
All right. Listeners, ask and you shall receive.
There you go.
So it fits beautifully because, Charlotte, you wrote a piece in The Independent about this very topic, which was brilliant, in which you essentially said, you know, you don't blame Felicity Huffman and the other individuals involved in this specific scandal, but that we have to look at the systemic problem of privilege and college admissions.
Well, I don't hate them is my point. Okay. And I do blame them.
Fair enough.
But I feel like an undue amount of vitriol is being directed toward these people, specifically these two women. Mm. Which I found, you know, fascinating in how we put that labor on mothers when we know that, you know, William H. Macy is Felicity Huffman's husband and, you know, he knew about this and yet he didn't really receive any vitriol whatsoever in the news cycle. That's the one thing. But the larger point is that the entire fucking college admission system is rigged from beginning to end. And I'm not just talking about testing, culturally biased testing in SAT and ACT. The, you know, industry of people who can pay for courses and coaches and who can't. But it goes far below that. And it's about just access to quality education in general and the way that we have segregated schools still that, you know, put an enormous deviation in the education of white kids versus children of color. And I mean, there's so many factors here
And I think getting bogged down in this one scandal without looking at the larger problem is really just kind of par for the course in this country. I wasn't surprised by this personally. Right. I wasn't at all surprised, but I think that, you know, that larger conversation is going to be, you know, very much avoided.
Well, if anything was surprising about it, it was that they would go the route of bribery and cheating when they really didn't have to, because there are so many not illegal forms of cheating you can use. There's just so many ways that, you know, as you mentioned in your piece, the traditional thing is you donate a big amount of money to the school. You donate to
you put your name on a building.
Yeah, you put your name on a building and your kid gets in. Like, that's how it's done. And I think it was Ben Dreyfuss who tweeted something like, you know, I got into college the old fashioned way. I let my parents' fame speak for itself.
But it's also what's interesting, though, because I was talking to somebody about this, and he was saying that there's like the front door of getting in, and then there's the back door, you build a building. But at this point, buildings are so expensive that what is your garden variety rich person who's not an oligarch supposed to do? And the person who organized this crime actually advertised this as the side door. It's not the front door. It's like, and I think some of the things that I found interesting in terms of reading to prepare for this, there is a beautiful article in Teen Vogue. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Teen Vogue, about the racism that's embedded in the development of the SATs. The development of how it worked was in white supremacy. When there were questions that Black students answered better than white students, they wouldn't use that question. Literally.
Okay, so I could do a whole episode on this. I'm going to really try to be brief. But the SAT was designed, it was supposed to forward the idea of meritocracy. The whole idea was that...
Because Rebecca, you do formal coaching on this, right?
I do. I have done SAT coaching for literally 20 years.
And, oh my God.
Yeah, I've been through multiple iterations of the test, and I also do other standardized tests, and I know them backwards and forwards, and I know a lot about the history of it. And the test was designed in principle to create some kind of objective evaluation of a student's potential, of a student's actual IQ. So right there, there's a flaw, because it's based on the belief that there's such a thing as IQ and it's measurable and so forth. But it was supposed to allow less affluent students an opportunity. But yes, it also had embedded within it a lot of really racist and sort of almost eugenicist suppositions. And it has a long history of cultural bias, and the industry around SAT prep is a whole thing. Like, I do it. That's what I do. I know what coaching can do to improve a student's score. I know that firsthand, and I know how much I fucking charge those kids. I have worked at nonprofits that offer coaching to students who ordinarily couldn't afford it, although that's not what I'm doing right now. But to the question of, well, what's a middle class or upper middle class parent supposed to do if they can't afford a building? I don't know how it is outside of New York, I'll grant you that. But in Manhattan, there is a whole system. And it's around hiring a person who's a college admissions coach or college admissions advisor. And, oh, they're supposed to coach you for the SAT, and they're going to help you write your essay, which means write your essay for you, and help you put together your extracurriculars and your whole package. But what they really do is know people. They know people on the admissions boards of various schools. And if they don't know someone, they know someone who knows someone. It's all about being connected in the right ways. And it boggles my mind that William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman didn't feel connected enough. But that's what you're supposed to do. And that's the legitimate, quote unquote, route.
That's the legitimate total like grift.
That's what real
for getting your child.
That's what real white rich people do.
Come on. But also, there was a beautiful article in New York Magazine from an anonymous article from a former admissions officer, somebody who worked in the admissions office of her kind of Tony private school on the East Coast after she graduated. And she was like, you know who gets in? White boys who can pay full tuition.
Yep.
Like, the amount of tuition help that they had was so limited that also already, if you could just pay the tuition, and I even see this in private schools in LA, like, if you can pay the tuition and they know you can pay the tuition, that immediately vaults you above any talented, intelligent student who might not be able to pay the tuition, who's going to need financial aid. Like, bam, like right there. So we'll post links to those articles. Another thing, but you mentioned this thing, Charlotte, and I really wanted to talk about this. Everybody is talking about Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin. Nobody is talking about the 35 other CEOs. I mean, there is a guy who is a lead managing partner of a major New York law firm. Like, everybody likes the actresses. It fits in with that whole, like, the things that white ladies will do to get right. their kid, you know, like, what's it called? Like, the cheerleader scandals.
Oh, yeah.
People love that story. People love white ladies living through their children's story. And meanwhile, we have, like, major CEOs, real estate development people, capital people, all of these men, where are their names? Does anybody know their names? Like, nobody knows their
names. I don't know a single other person in this. Single other person. When you mentioned the SATs and the history of them, it made me think that it almost sounds like the SATs are like the electoral college of because they're supposed to be the great equalizer, but they have a racist history, and in practice, it doesn't really work at all. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Right. It's absolutely true. I really want to talk about how this relates to a larger issue in American culture and politics, which is the myth of meritocracy. Mm. We have this idea in our culture that through hard work and innate talent, you can succeed, and that because America is this land of opportunity, you know, it doesn't matter where you come from. We're supposed to have this like social mobility, and you'll be able to achieve whatever you want. And that's actually really, really untrue.
Yeah.
I mean, just based on class statistics, social mobility, the ability to move from like the bottom two quintiles to the top two in the United States lags far behind most other Western countries.
Right.
How does this myth of meritocracy get so perpetuated? We're so bought into it. What is the appeal of it that we cling to it despite substantial evidence that it doesn't exist?
Well, you know, I think it's two things. First of all, I think it's the way that, you know, it allows us to not focus on areas of privilege, right?
Yeah.
If we perpetuate this bootstraps theory, if we, you know, talk about all it takes is hard work to get somewhere, then it allows us to say, you know, yes, the world is unfair, but as long as you are the hardest working person, you're going to overcome this and you're going to succeed. And the second thing is that, you know, I personally think that just about every white American knows that we are privileged. Every single one, even the most racist, vile white people in this country know that the white privilege exists. And, you know, it's very easy for them to, and not only them, but like middle class progressive white folks. It's very easy for them to like ignore privilege and you know, pretend that it doesn't play as big a factor as it does.
It's in our interest to ignore it and pretend that it's not a factor. And I think you see that so clearly when people talk about affirmative action. Because the argument against affirmative action is that it undermines meritocracy somehow. That the problem in college admissions and hiring practices is that people are being advanced just because of the color of their skin. When that is true, but it's not the people you think are being advanced.
Well, that's one thing that I found really interesting about this week, that so many writers, people of color, have gone on and been like, when I was in high school, do you know how many people said to me, you just got into this school because you're Black. You just got into the school because you're Latino.
Yeah.
And I think about that, that University of Texas case where that white girl was like, I didn't get into U of T because I was white. And
she was a completely mediocre student.
Mediocre student. But it's because they feel like she felt like it is my right to be mediocre and get in. So other people took my spot. They took my spot. You can't say to somebody, you only got in because of this, this, and that, unless you think it's your spot to get.
Right. And that's where it ties into privilege. Because as Charlotte said, people are aware of their privilege, but I think on a conscious level, they take their privilege to be not privilege. They take it to be just the way things are supposed to be, entitlement, something they're entitled to. And so when their privilege is taken away, it feels like they have been disadvantaged, even though in fact the advantage they had was taken away. That's pretty typical. Another thing, Charlotte, that you brought up in your article that I wanted to address is you talked about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as an example of someone who has succeeded by virtue of hard work and has reached the highest levels of power based on that. And one thing that you didn't explicitly bring up that was sort of implied is the way that the right tends to smear her. You said that people are incredulous that she could have achieved all of this. And the way you see that manifested often is that they smear her as being secretly rich. They're like, yeah. Oh, she's really from Westchester. She actually is lying about being a Latina from the Bronx. She's a child of privilege. Mm-hmm. And they're attempting to paint her as a hypocrite and a liar. But what's interesting about it is they're really kind of telling on themselves. They're suggesting that there's just no way she could have achieved all that unless she already had all these advantages.
It just the way they betray themselves so blatantly is remarkable. I mean, I remember there was, you know, two whole news cycles about her dressing smartly for the office.
Yeah.
Like, God forbid she wear, you know, a good looking skirt suit that she got on sale, because that must mean that she didn't come from privilege or that she, you know, stole campaign funds or whatever the hell. And, you know, I think race that's a bad word for that, but aggressively exacerbates this effect. But I think even, you know, poor white folks get this. I remember when I did a thread about my white trash upbringing, essentially, I got conservative white folks who sent me messages saying, there's no way you grew up poor, because they felt like
really
a demonstration of good grammar and punctuation and education must mean that there's no way I could have been raised in a trailer park.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness.
These folks are classist as fuck.
Well, I want to bring up something about class. So I've been reading Nancy Eisenberg's book, White Trash, which is a 400-year history of class in America. And it's awesome. It's a really good book. And I'm still in colonial times. But what's amazing is that she's saying, like, we like to have this fantasy that America was somehow from the beginning, from the time of the colonies, that America was this like classless fantasia. People left for the new world. And once they landed here, all their old ideas about class went away. And she's like, of course that's not true. And she goes through in excruciating detail the ways in which British ideas about class absolutely came over with the colonists, and that actually that very few of the colonists were actually fleeing for reasons of religious persecution, that is very much a 19th century fantasia, but that actually most of the people sent here to work in the colonies were regarded as waste people. Hmm. Very much like with Australia, we are going to send our waste people to this colony to produce wealth for the England, for the elite. And that white trash has always been profound in the American politic, is that we believe that there are people who do not deserve to fully participate in a citizenship life because they are waste people.
I mean, that's the term, white trash. You're calling them garbage people.
Yes.
I feel like it's even more insidious because we have this founding mythology of meritocracy. It's essential to our self-conception as a nation. We really believe that this is the place, the land of opportunity. That's what we call ourselves, right? This is the place where immigrants come and anybody can be anything they want to be in America. That's so essential to our identity, our self-identity as a nation. And because of that, we don't see the lack of social mobility and economic mobility. We don't see the class system that actually is there, and that makes it even worse.
Right.
And you'll notice that white people will recognize privilege when it's convenient to them. So especially poor and middle-class white folks, they'll say, oh, those rich elites in Washington who have so much power and control, but that's not me. I don't have privilege. That doesn't exist. But
as far as an overarching interconnected system of, you know, oppression and privilege, they can't recognize it because it would mean examining what privileges they have as well.
Yeah.
You know, yes. And I can say any self-reflective, honest white person who was raised in poverty like myself can tell you that we absolutely benefit from having white skin. We do. Like, there's no way that I would have excelled in the military without being white or, you know, done as well in school. I mean, I remember being in a predominantly black middle school. And I mean, there were teachers who were black who like took an interest in me and, you know, were very kind and nurturing. And I did not see them do that with some black students who came from the same background. I mean, this is an insidious thing that kind of infects all corners of society. And we're not honest about it. We're really not.
I think that the insidiousness of it and the anxiety of it, there was an article a couple of years ago about, like, we are in a moment of extreme inequity in wealth. And what we're seeing among the wealthy is such extreme anxiety of maintaining that. Mm-hmm. Like, this is anxiety. This isn't parents being like, look, my kid is not going to go to Yale. They'll go wherever they go to college. Or like Lori Loughlin, my daughter is an Instagram influencer. That's what she's going to do. This insane anxiety of maintaining this dominance is being performed through their children in this way that is really, really interesting. And that's what you also see along all these levels as well. A lot of this is the anxiety of the thought that I'm not going to get to use this anymore. Mm-hmm. It's really insane. And it's something that I think about a lot because I see it on this very minor level right now with all these parents getting their kids into preschool or elementary school in LA, all of these hyper overeducated, anxious parents mm-hmm. pulling their kids out of the public school system because they're so afraid, even though they were able to buy property and get themselves into probably the best of LAUSD. And this real feeling like if I don't get this now, what's going to happen to my child?
My kid will never get into Harvard if they don't start at the right preschool. I tutor students for private high school admissions tests and private middle school admissions tests. I tutor fourth graders for admissions tests for middle school. It's wild. And there absolutely are preschool admission tutors. There are people who will.
No, there are
no,
not.
100% there are. There are people who will work with your preschooler, get them ready for their interview / test for preschool admissions. It's incredibly competitive in Manhattan.
If you're a parent with a preschooler who's watching this, you can absolutely pay me to tutor your preschooler. I will take your money and tutor your kid. I will totally do it.
It's really like I will charge bargain rates compared to what you might find on the market. I swear.
Wow.
Yeah. No, it's so fucked up. It goes back to the whole reason we have this myth of meritocracy. This ideology just supports the status quo. That's the whole point. If we believe that achievement is earned through merit and failure is earned through lack of it, then people who are rich and successful must have merited it, and people who fail must have not.
They cheated fair and square.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, but there's also, it's making me think of like a couple of things, this idea, and actually Tressie McMillan-Cottom talks about this, about opportunity hoarding. How like, it's not just that people hoard money, but they hoard opportunity, just even in terms of how entitled parents will make sure that their kid gets into the best teacher at their public school that they bought their way into. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of labor that goes into like protecting your child's sort of course and path. And with the increase of privilege comes the increase of anxiety to do that. I don't remember this from when I was growing up. I really don't. It's almost like the worse things get. And you're like, shouldn't you guys at this point just be like, we got all the shit? I do want to just mention some of the names of the other parents, because there was literally a parent who paid $6.5 million to get their kid into college. Like, so we have Gordon Kaplan, a co-chairman of the global law firm Wilkie Farr and Gallagher. We have William McClashen, a partner at a private equity firm. We have, I want to get a slew of CEOs. I'm interested in the CEOs. These are people who, like, their kids don't even have to go to college ever. Gregory right. Abbott and his wife, Marcia Abbott. He's the founder and chairman of International Dispensing Corp, a food and beverage packaging company. We have Gamal Aziz Abdelaziz of Los Angeles, the former president and executive director of Wynn Macau. Todd Blake, an entrepreneur and investor. And then this is what I love. Amy Colburn and Gregory Colburn of Palo Alto, California.
We'll just leave that That's mysterious.
It. Just okay. Palo Alto.
So I just want to finish this conversation with one last thought, which is, if we're going to pretend that America is a meritocracy, how do we square that with the fact that Donald Trump is the president of the fucking United States? Like, if you need any evidence that that is bullshit, it's right there. It's in our faces every day. This boob of a person is president.
And we just had Michael Cohen be like, and one of my jobs was to call every single one of his old schools and threaten them with, like, death and castration if they, like, reveal his test scores and his grades.
Because he's a nincompoop. But he's in the fucking Oval Office because of his various privileges he's had over the course of his life. So... Meritocracy, oh my God!
Remarkable
fuck you.
About that story, by the way. Here's what's the cherry on top of this. This was days after he demanded to see President Obama's transcripts and passport and all his records, but especially his school records, just days before that. And then he tries to destroy his own records that would have showed he's a shitty student. I mean, this is, I just, no one looking at this can claim that we live in a meritocracy. That it's not the way it works.
It also goes to Trump's tendency to project whatever he's accusing someone else of, you know, he's done. So when he came out with, oh, we need to see Obama's school records, and then days later is like, let's make sure we destroy my school records.
Yeah. Well, but I feel transparent. But it's also that thing where he's such a, it's like crooks can never believe that other people aren't crooks.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's hard for... like it's hard for,
that's him to
like,
escape.
Like, they can't believe that other I'm people might do stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
legitimately, yeah.
But I think that that brings us back to this idea that I've been thinking about so much, especially as I've had kids and watched these anxious parents around me. How can we get people to think about the choices they make for their kids' education in terms of what's best for their community and not just what's best for their kid? And how is it that they think that sending somebody else to take their kid's test is best for their kid?
Right.
Like, that's the other thing that's very painful about this. Like, do you think this is actually better for your kid? And it instantiates the idea of privilege, that cheating is fine because I deserve it. How is that better for your kid? I was entitled to it all along.
It's not better.
And I have the rather, and this is kind of controversial, or this will be controversial. You know, I have the opinion that, you know, we should want every child to be happy and to succeed in some way, but we should probably communicate to our children who are white males that, you know, they do have an unusual level of privilege and they need to be aware of that. And, you know, maybe step back from some leadership opportunities. Mm. You know, don't go for class president. You know, support someone else who's going for it, or at least consider it.
Right.
And
yeah.
I think inculcating that value of inclusivity and taking a step back from the table so others can sit down is really important at that time.
I totally agree. But good luck communicating that to people in a way that they will be open to.
You know what, Charlotte? You know who would fucking hate that opinion? Is Tucker Carlson.
Right. Yeah. In a not unrelated topic, let's move on because we got to talk about that. So speaking of meritocracy and the complete lack of it in American culture, in recent days, there was some controversy surrounding our dear friend Tucker Carlson. good old
friend,
Tucker.
Friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod, Tucker. Yeah, right? That would be amusing. Good. Yeah, so Tucker Carlson got in some hot water for comments he made on a podcast, I guess, 10 years ago.
Like a Sirius XM radio,
radio show.
Oh, was it a radio show? Yeah, okay, my bad. So a radio show. What was the name of the...
Bubba the Love Sponge.
So
Mr.
He was,
Love Sponge.
So Tucker was chatting with Mr. Love Sponge and said some things that some people found a little offensive. You know, your garden variety, sexist, racist bullshit. And it blew up and, you know, there was a hashtag fire Tucker Carlson and so forth. So a couple things that I think we need to discuss about this. Number one is the extent to which Tucker Carlson embodies white privilege in so many ways. And the other thing is, why this? Like, how is it that comments made on some fucking Sirius XM show 10 years ago are going to catch everyone's attention when every week he is on Fox News saying appalling shit?
I think these are the main questions. I just want to briefly just give a shout out to Media Matters researcher Madeline Peltz.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, yes.
Literally just sat her way through fucking hundreds of hours of Tucker Carlson to cull these gems. Madeline, we salute you.
Yes. That is not the work I would be willing to do. Snaps for Madeline. Absolutely. Yeah. No question.
All right. So let's get to, why this now?
I feel like there's a phenomenon where the right have developed this system. They find someone who is critical of Trump, and they find someone they don't like, and they delve into that person's past, and they find the tweets or they find the comments that are controversial. They take them out of context. They create a fake campaign of offense, and they get that person fired or in hot water. I mean, they did it very successfully with, like, James Gunn, the director of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. There's other examples. Sometimes it works for them, sometimes it doesn't. And somehow this feels like the left trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Trying to dig and find that gem that's just going to ruin the person. When, I mean, has anyone ever listened to anything Tucker Carlson has said? He parrots white supremacist, white nationalist talking points on his show every time he's on.
Oh, yeah. I think we're reaching the point where everything has to be spelled out explicitly.
Mm.
There's no room for nuance or sleight of hand anymore in order for them to be held accountable. I mean, because you're right. He called Iraqis monkeys.
Yeah.
He literally referred to Iraqis as illiterate monkeys in these recordings. And it made me think, unless he either says the N-word or jokes about, you know, raping children, he's not going to be held accountable. Knock on wood, but I feel like we're going to get to a point in society in the next 5 years, if this keeps going, where white people are just going to start saying the N-word openly. And that sounds insane to me, but it would not surprise me if, like, a year from now, Sean Hannity just drops it on air and doesn't resign and Fox News keeps him on air. I mean, honestly, that's where we're going.
I feel like you're right. And this comes back to this idea that I've talked about before, where, like, Fox News is like a cult, and just like a cult leader, what happens in a cult is that the cult leader keeps raising the stakes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're like, the world's going to end next week, and then it doesn't. So they have to raise the stakes and be like, no, the world's really going to end, but it's going to be really bad. And they raise the stakes until it leads to helter skelter. Like, that's basically until something so violent, so horrible happens that law enforcement gets involved and the cult falls apart. And I feel like that with Fox News, the kind of stakes that they're raising and their willingness to raise it is amazing.
But look at Trump. There's the pussy grabbing tape. He said all kinds of things that no one else could have gotten away with. And the bar just keeps getting raised higher and higher on what you have to do. And I've actually had this conversation, like, what would happen if the Apprentice tapes come out and you hear him using the N-word? Like, is that it? Is that the,
right.
Is that the straw? Is that finally it? Matt, my husband Matt's idea is he thinks that would be it because he looks at people like his own family members who are conservatives and he feels like they don't understand racism at all, but they know you're not supposed to say the N-word. Like, that's nope. Like, they get that.
Yeah, I think what would happen is that the right-wing media machine would jump into high gear, and it would do two things. First of all, it would say, well, these tapes are from over 10 years ago, It's incredibly wrong to not give people the room to grow. And second, the left clearly does not hold themselves to the same standard in terms of hatred, blah, 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 blah. You know, and his base would remain solid. His, like, 33-34% or whatever the hell would remain rock solid. And that's why I keep telling people over and over and over and over and over again, I feel like I'm talking to a fucking brick wall at this point, that we need to stop pandering to this bullshit segment of the country. They don't care. They don't care.
And you are not going to reach them.
You're not going to reach them.
And that's why, to me, like, again, I'm going to bring her up again. Stacey motherfucking Abrams. Because she's the only person who's like, I'm not going to go get those votes.
Right.
Fuck that. Why would I go get those votes?
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
I'm not wasting my time trying to shift my performance of myself to please those people. Why do you go after those people? We don't need their votes. Like, fuck that.
That thinking is outdated. I mean, it's just demographically outdated. And as we go forward, it's going to become less and less relevant.
I know. But then again, we are using, with this revelation, and I love Media Matters. I think that they do such good fucking work. They are amazing analysts of media. And I think as an analytical performance, what they did with Tucker Carlson is fantastic. I think when liberals try to pick it up and do with it what the conservatives do, saying, like, we're going to go for the 33% of voters, letting our language be shaped by the right wing, which it has for so long. Mm-hmm. We see it in a million different ways. I want abortion to be safe, legal, and rare, like, whatever.
Yeah.
All of that way in which they lead the rhetorical wave and then liberals somehow respond to it and try to win according to those rules. It is a mistake to try to shame him into anything. I just don't know if shaming him off the air is going to work. I think that, again, that's the liberals trying to use the tools of the right wing.
Yeah, which is ironic because I do think the right wing developed those tools because they appeared to be the tools of the liberals. Like, initially, calling someone out for racism was a liberal thing and people's careers. Oh, what happened to Roseanne Barr? So they turn that on its head and then they attack people they don't like for their supposed transgressions. The problem is that their version of it is completely insincere. And we can't do the same thing. And I don't mean to suggest that Media Matters or anyone is insincere in their attack on Tucker Carlson, but it does miss the bigger picture if we focus on comments he made trying to be edgy on an edgy radio show 10 years ago. What we should be talking about is what he's saying right now and how that's unacceptable. And yes, he and Fox News and those 35% of people are going to perpetually rationalize that shit. They will always have some disingenuous rationalization why it's okay, why he's not actually being a racist. But you're not going to get anywhere engaging in that argument.
I do think it's important for Media Matters to do this campaign. I mean, you know, the research, of course, as all of us praised earlier in the program, is important. But for them to do this campaign is also important because it demonstrates a pattern.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
It demonstrates that it wasn't this thing where, like, you know, for example, Joanne Reed, she said some homophobic and transphobic things like 8 or 9 years ago. And then, you know, she, of course, evolved over time. And now she's an amazing ally, does a lot of great work for LGBTQ people.
Right.
That's different.
Right. Because you can't just, there's no pattern there. There's clear change.
Right. Like, if Tucker were, you know, if he had a program now where he was, you know, reasonable and, you know, maybe not all there yet, but at least reasonable, then I would be like, is this really helping anybody? But no, this is demonstrating that this guy has always been this way. Even when he was a fucking moderate, so-called moderate hack on MSNBC and CNN, for that matter, this is what he's always thought.
I wonder, and you brought up Roseanne. She's been saying fucking disgusting shit for years, years. I mean, if you want the receipts on that shit, God, they got him. But it was almost like bringing up the receipts does make us then watch for what she's going to do next. And then when she did something just beyond the pale, it's like we were ready. And I wonder if this is going to perhaps structure a kind of readiness for the next time he calls Iraqis monkeys or whatever. But I don't know, because if his audience, if that's what they fucking want,
and it is,
if that's what they want, I don't know.
There's the sponsors, and
right,
maybe if sponsors drop out, it becomes a problem. But yeah, that's what he does. That's why he has a show. That's the whole point of it. And he wouldn't have that platform, to circle back to our earlier conversation, if he hadn't started from a place of privilege. You have this young white guy, when he first came on the scene and was on CNN in the 90s, he was this young, reasonably good-looking white guy in a bow tie. And it was this cute novelty that he was conservative, you know, your cute young conservative guy in a bow tie was a whole thing. And he's just saying the same shit that creepy old white dudes say all the time, but it was right in this younger package.
Oh yeah, oh look, it's me, it's me as a young man. Oh yeah, I'm so yeah glad that there is someone in the youth who is me.
Mm-hmm. Oh Jesus Christ.
Exactly.
I have to mention something. I did not know this. I just went onto Wikipedia. Can I just share a little bit about Tucker Carlson's early life?
Because okay.
I
did not know any of this.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Enlighten us all. Yeah.
He's the elder son of Richard Warner Carlson, a former LA news anchor and the U.S. ambassador to the Seychelles, who was also president of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the director of Voice of America. What? And then his mother left the family when Carlson was six, wanting to pursue a bohemian lifestyle.
What is her background?
I don't know. She just left. She moved to France and didn't talk to her family after that.
Heiress. Well, no wonder he's a misogynist. His mommy left him.
The heiress is his stepmother, who is
there we go.
Patricia yeah Swanson, an heiress to the Swanson frozen food.
He's a frozen fish heir.
And he also grew up in La Jolla. He went to La Jolla Country Day.
No.
Yes, he did.
I went to Country Day.
No, you did not.
I did.
You were there at the same time as Tucker Carlson.
I think he's a little older than we are.
He's older than you.
You take away the frozen fish fortune and
the Corporation for Public Broadcasting
The media connections and the young white man thing. And what do you have? Just the same shit.
Right.
He's, well, I remember, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, I used to go to this Bible study with this guy. I don't want to say his name on air because that wouldn't be nice, but he was obsessed with Carlson. He worked at the Heritage Foundation. He wore a bow tie with his, with his suits. And he was a nice person much of the time. Like, he was cordial. He was sweet. And then he would say shit like, oh, yeah, the people that lost their houses in the housing crisis deserve to lose their houses. And I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. What are you talking
Whoa
about? And I would have to walk him through this process of examining, like, maybe the talking points that you hear from your hero aren't really that great.
Was he receptive to that?
So sometimes we would argue, and sometimes he'd be like, well, yeah, you're right. And he would get a little defensive, but then he would, accept that maybe, this blatantly stupid shit he said was wrong. But then other stuff he just dug his heels on. Like, mm-hmm, I don't think we ever had a conversation on white privilege where he did not get really defensive and just refuse to acknowledge it. Like, there's no way. Like, I have a bunch of friends who are white and, they grew up poor and they managed to lift themselves up out of poverty. And I'm like, oh, my God.
I think that's one of the things we were talking about in an earlier episode, where there's that moment where they say, oh, well, that's the truth. Well, I don't even care if that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They have mastered rationalizing because they have values, and it is easier for them to rationalize just about anything. They believe that their inconsistency is permissible because it validates their anger. Whereas our biggest strength as the liberal movement is our diversity of thought and background. Our biggest weakness as the liberal movement is our diversity of thought and background, because it's bringing everybody together. They don't give a shit. They are racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, xenophobic, all that stuff. And as long as, the person next to you is validating that part of you, you don't care. You just don't care.
It's like cognitive dissonance coping strategies. That's what it always comes down to.
Yes.
We said that about Bernie supporters last week. What's actually true stops mattering. If you throw at me a fact, piece of information, anything that contradicts what I've already chosen to believe, I'm going to rationalize away the contradicting cognition rather right. than change my belief. And
yes,
boy, have we seen that in stark relief over the past few years.
And I want to be clear, you know, there are certainly folks who support Bernie who are quite rational and blah, blah, blah.
Of course.
I mean, and we're not talking about all of them, but oh my God, with so many, there is just this aggressive either sea lioning or bastardized version of sea lioning where mm-hmm. they use logic or quote unquote logic in incredibly poor form or incredibly bad faith, not so much to reach a logical consensus, but simply to, I guess, win an argument in their own mind or to avoid. And so they legalese every bit of it. Mm-hmm. It's absurd. It's so goddamn absurd. And I just want to pull them inside and be like, if you think this is, I mean, I always say this to some Bernie supporters who just go fire and brimstone on the rest of us on the left. I'm like, look, if this isn't working with us, how in your mind is this going to work with folks on the right?
Yeah.
When you, because here's what they think. They honestly believe, and I swear to God, this is what they believe. They believe that as long as they speak to broad economic issues with the right and focus on kitchen table stuff, mm-hmm. that people on the right are going to come over.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. They're going to see the light.
They think that
they're going to see the light.
What's standing in the way of that is the centrist Democrats.
Yes.
That the problem actually is the centrist Democrats who are preventing them from being able to get their economic message to those right wingers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Me being a trans woman and wanting to use the public restroom, I'm right. standing in the way.
Right. Well, you identity know,
they're yeah. brilliant arguments to the right.
They're never going to come over.
No, they're not. Like, it's a waste never of time. Happen. And it's yeah. it pretty much always has been.
Well, Charlotte, it was awesome having you on.
Thank you so much.
Oh my God. We hope to bring you back on because I know there's going to be some insane week where the trigger issue comes up for us yeah. to talk about. The performance of patriotism.
Yes.
Especially on the left and how to kind of own that if it is at all possible and what to even do with that and what even is that. That was what going to be our original topic, and we hope we can have you back to have that conversation with us.
I would love to be back. This is such a fun, I mean, I really wish I was drinking right now because I'm having such a good time talking right. to both.
Well, next time we're going to do it at a time when you can have a drink.
That's right. That's yes. right.
When I'm not at work and my, you know, supervisors aren't sweating bullets over what I'm saying. So, that sounds great. I would love to be back. And I just got to say, you know, Rebecca, Maya, you two are amazing. Rebecca and I have been friends for, God, six years or something
now.
Like that. And
but you know what? We've been online friends. This is the first time we've actually spoken and heard each
that's
other's
true.
Voices.
Whoa.
That's true.
Yeah.
Amazing.
We've talked a lot and got to know each other over online, but this is actually the first time we've done anything face to face. So
well, we are going to see you again.
Yeah, you all too.
Right. We'll be thinking of you when you're having your gin and tonics.
I can't wait.
Oh my God, we have to have her back. That was so
good. That was great.
All right, everybody. So I would hope you all realize that you asked and we provided. So we hope y'all keep asking.
Yes.
Email us, saucepodcast@gmail.com. Find us at saucepodcast. You can find us on the Twitter, on the Insta, on the Facebook, on all the places.
On all the places. Let us know your thoughts and reactions to the episode. Let us know what else you might like us to ruin. And you can find me, Rebecca, as at GynoStar on all those various platforms.
You can find me at Maya Garance anywhere you are looking for Maya Garances.
Maya, you have a bunch of new Twitter followers recently, don't you?
Oh my God.
How many are you at this point?
Well, you know, I only started, I was at around 400, and now I'm at around 700, so that's pretty
very
good.
Nice. No, that's a good percent increase.
A lot of people have read this Manafort essay and just written the most amazing responses to it. We also have a lot of people who are like very reactive left-wingers who are like, I told you Manafort's the devil! And they're like, yeah, I mean, he is.
Yes.
Yes, he's a little more complicated than that, but yeah, no, he is. Yeah.
Yeah, everything's more complicated than that, but that's kind of the whole point of our show.
Yeah.
So everybody, Follow Maya on Twitter so she can get above 1,000 followers. That's the next goal,
please.
Right?
Yes, there's please.
Metrics. We've got to boost those metrics.
Metrics, people.
Reach out. We look forward to hearing from you.
Talk to you next week.
Adios, amoebas.